Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Aparita te sangha tassa dwara yeso tavanto pamanchantu sadhanti. Okay, so for the talk this evening, I'd like to speak a little bit about how the sangha works. Now, most of you probably know that in Buddhism we have a community of Buddhist followers, and that community is structured into the monastic community and the lay community. And the Buddha gave various guidelines for how these communities should live. And for the lay community, the Buddha only gave very kind of general ethical precepts, but there's no kind of guidelines on sort of for lay communities how to organize themselves and so on and so forth. But with the monastic community, we have a very detailed description of how the monks and the nuns are supposed to live, how they're supposed to do things. And these are very interesting teachings and principles which show how the Dhamma becomes applied in very practical contexts. Now, last year I was invited to give a talk at a seminar on mindfulness in the workplace, right? Corporate mindfulness. So how do you be mindful while you're working? Well, there's many different answers and so on to that. But my first response to say, well, how could I answer that question? I'm a monk. I'm a no good dropout who's of no use to society. And I have no corporate. And then I was thinking, hang on. Sangha is kind of like a corporation, isn't it? In fact, we're like the world's oldest multinational corporation with franchises all over the world for more than 2,000 years, right? Take that, McDonald's, right? Let's see if McDonald's is here in 2,000 years' time, right? So we must be doing something right, right? Just have a think about that. 2,500 years, okay? There is nothing like it. If you look at all the different religions and so on in the world, there's nothing that's comparable to that, okay? 2,500 years all over the world. All the other monastic orders we know are much younger, or they're much more limited in scope. But Buddhism survived and thrived, and the Buddha Sangha adapted and changed throughout the years. So there's something there. There's something that we should consider in terms of actually how a community lives, how it functions. And it's very often that we, when we come to the Dhamma, that we learn very nice teachings about letting go, and we learn about emptiness or meditation and mindfulness and all of these wonderful spiritual qualities. But then, of course, when you go to work, And somebody's just stuffed up the coffee machine before you've got to it in the morning, right? And then all of those teachings go out the window. And you're like, I've got all this work to do and I need my coffee in my mind. And so how do you actually do all of those things? How do you live from day to day? And in the Vinaya, we find wonderful principles for dealing with all of these kinds of things. There's a whole chapter in the Vinaya that deals with toilets. Yes, a whole chapter. Many of you have been to India in recent years, and you're thinking they could probably use a few lessons on getting toilets together, right? 2,500 years ago, a whole chapter on how toilets work and how you keep them clean and what's the right way of looking after them and maintaining them and the etiquette and all the hygiene and all of those kinds of things. So I'm not going to give you all of the details about the toilets chapter. You can go and read that yourself. But what I'd like to talk about is some of the principles and the organization and the structure and so on, because some of those things are actually very, very useful and very applicable in all kinds of ways. So let me start by just telling a bit of a story, the background of how all this began. It begins on the night of the Buddha's enlightenment. And this story that I'm about to tell is told in the first chapter of the Vinaya Khandakas, if you want to look it up. and read it for yourself. It's a very nice story, but I'll just tell it very briefly for now, and the Buddha's enlightenment. And then after he was enlightened, as is well known according to the story, he hesitated about whether he should teach the Dhamma. Right? So he did all of this practice and all of this meditation and everything, and then at the end of the day he's like, all these people, no one's going to understand. Right? Dhamma is very, very subtle. And I've done all of this practice. Who else is going to be able to do that? Who's going to understand? And so he thought, nah, I'll just go off and be peaceful, do my meditation. And according to the legend, no less than Brahma himself came to see the Buddha and begged him and invited him to teach the Dhamma. And he said that there will be some who understand. And so the Buddha reflected, and he knew with his mind that even though the Dhamma was very subtle, that there would be some who had little dust in their eyes who would understand the Dhamma. Little dust in their eyes. Okay? So, he began to teach, and the first group that he taught was, of course, the group of five monks in Benares. He taught the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the rolling forth of the wheel of the Dhamma, at the end of which those five monks became enlightened, and they became the first of the Buddha's monastic followers. Now, when you have a very small community of, you know, who people are very close to you and people who are very dedicated and experienced, and in that case, well, they were enlightened as well, so that's pretty good, then you don't really have to do much in terms of running a community, right? Everything's pretty easy. But as time went on, more and more followers started to come, and they started to have a need to lay down rules and have guidelines and so on for running the community. The first thing, according to the story we have, whether it's chronologically the first is difficult to say, but the first thing that we're told that the Buddha did was to describe an ordination ceremony. And this is very, very important. In the early part of the Buddhist community, when somebody wanted to come and ordain, they would come to the Buddha and they would ask, and the Buddha would accept them, and then they'd go and practice. Okay? But then after a while, the monks would go out in different directions and teach. Other followers wanted to come. And how did they get ordained? So originally they would all go to the Buddha and the Buddha would do it himself. But after a while it became a bit inconvenient. And so the Buddha said, no, let's let the Sangha do that. Let's let the Sangha do the ordination. Very, very important. Okay? So the Buddha was not a control freak. He didn't want to, he wasn't a micromanager. Yeah? He wasn't a narcissist. Hopefully it's not a surprise for you to learn these things, right? He wanted to empower his Sangha, to empower his community. And so apart from all of the other wonderful things, we think of the Buddha as such a great meditator, as such a great teacher, and so on and so forth. But he was also a great leader, right? A person who would run a community, bring people together and manage a community in an enlightened way. And that's something which is quite amazing, right? It's giving us a precedent. How would such a wise, enlightened being run these things on a day-to-day basis? And this is giving us those principles that we can apply. So the first thing is, well, to empower people and not to hold on. Right? Give people the responsibility. Now, what happened in those cases was that they gave the responsibility, you can do the ordination, you go forth, charata bhikkhave, wander forth, O monks, for the benefit and the welfare of the many folk. And they performed the ordination, but then sometimes there would be problems. And in that chapter, there's a whole list of different kinds of problems, many, many different kinds of things that would happen. And it shows how the Buddha would respond to each problem. But the important principle to remember here is that the Buddha didn't try to anticipate all of the problems beforehand. Okay? He didn't say, what's the best possible ordination system? And I'm going to write it out because I'm the Buddha. Okay? I know. So therefore, this is what we should do. Right? But that's kind of what we think, isn't it, right? Because we actually have egos and conceit and stuff, which, of course, the Buddha wasn't a problem for the Buddha. So we think we know how these projects should be run. We know how these people should work. We know how these things should be done. So I'm going to tell all these people how they should do their job. So we micromanage and we tell people what to do. So the Buddha didn't do that. He empowered people, okay? So he would give advice and suggestions and encouragement, but he wasn't trying to control them. But then he also didn't abandon them, right? This is the other side. So letting go doesn't just mean not caring. It doesn't just mean whatever, okay? Just do what you want. It's none of my business, okay? When problems came, he would deal with them. And he would deal with them fairly. He would deal with them swiftly. And he would deal with them finally, right? So that they didn't arise again, okay? And typically, how that would happen would be something like this. So I'll just give you one example. As I mentioned, there's dozens, possibly hundreds, even just in this case of the ordination procedure. One case came when, and I'm just trying to think of a good example to use, when a criminal wanted to ordain as a monk. Okay? Right? So what happens when somebody comes and they're wanted by the king, right? For various crimes, and they come and they say they want to ordain as a monk, right? So in the beginning, the Sangha just said, okay, that's all right, you can be a monk, come and be a monk. And then the king was put in a bit of a quandary there, right? Because he didn't want to go around arresting monks and chopping their heads off or throwing them in jail or something like that. So he went to the Buddha and complained about it and said, well, this has happened. And so the Buddha made a rule that if somebody is a wanted criminal, right? And by wanted, it means they have to be advertised. So literally, you have a wanted notice put out for them, right? So you can't obviously, the monks can't know if somebody's just committed a crime, right? But we can know if somebody's actually wanted by the police or by the authorities. So if somebody's a wanted criminal, then they shouldn't be ordained. So then he just changed that rule, and then that became part of the procedure. Another instance was when the Buddha and the Sangha was being looked after by the doctor, Jivaka, who was the king's doctor, and he was the best known doctor in India at the time. And when people were sick, they didn't have health care. And so they used to think, oh, I can come and become a monk, and then they've got really good health care plans. And so Jivaka, the king's doctor, will look after me. So then everybody, whenever you'd have a plague or people would get sick, then they'd all come and they'd ordain. And no one really minded too much, except it just became a burden after a while, right? So after a while you had so many people ordaining, not really because they wanted to practice, but they just wanted medical care. And then the Sangha had to spend all their time looking after them. So the Buddha said, well, look, if you've got a very serious medical condition that requires intensive care, then also you shouldn't ordain. And on it goes. And so these were the kind of cases which we had where people would create some kind of problem and the Buddha would respond to it. Now, so this is giving some idea of how the Buddha worked, that he would not try to solve all the problems in advance. It would be very simple and straightforward and just deal with issues as they arose. And he'd deal with each issue in quite a reasonable kind of manner. And as the Sangha began to grow, then there also became a need for more and more communities and for people to live together and to live together in harmony. And so it became necessary to devise a way for the community to actually make decisions and to run itself. And to me, this is perhaps the most brilliant part of the whole Vinaya. This is what we call the Vinaya, is the code of conduct for monks and nuns. Right? So the Vinaya, when people think about the Vinaya, right, they think about a set of rules. Right? They think, oh, monks and nuns have lots of rules that they have to follow, and it seems like it's really kind of hardcore and it's really kind of difficult and so on. But in fact, a large part of the Vinaya, and the most important part from a practical point of view, is not about telling you what rules and things that you shouldn't do, but what you should do, okay? How you should live your life, how you should live as a community. And the basic way, the basic format that the community runs is like this, and I'll just sort of describe it in general principles to start with, and we'll have a look at a few examples. The basic idea is that the authority rests with the Sangha. Okay? The authority rests with the community, and the community is operating in line with the Vinaya. Right? So the community, the Sangha, can't just arbitrarily do whatever it wants, right? It has to make decisions in line with the Vinaya. But once the community has made decisions that are in line with the Vinaya, then those are authoritative and they're binding, okay? And within the community, no monk and no nun has any authority whatsoever, right? No general authority. There is no power of command in the Vinaya, okay? You think about this. Think about the implications of this, okay? There is no power of command. Right? Now, I'm a senior monk. I've been around for more than 20 years now. So, you know, I should be able to tell these juniors here, go get here, get this, do this, and so on. And of course I do, right? But, and most of the time, it's not a problem, right? Right? Normally you ask somebody to do something, they'll do it just because they're nice and so on. But if somebody says, no, I don't want to, right, which does happen from time to time, I can't force them, okay? There's no kind of requirement for obedience, right? As you find, say, in the Christian orders, right? They make a vow to be obedient. We don't have that, okay? So, and I'll talk more about that in a little while, but the basic idea is that the authority rests with the Sangha, and it's up to the Sangha to make decisions. Now, immediately, what many of you may be thinking is, crikey, all those committee meetings, right? That means every time you've got to figure out, you know, where do you keep the toilet paper? Then you've got to get the Sangha together and everyone's got to agree on, do you keep the toilet paper downstairs or upstairs? And you're going to be sitting there discussing that for 5 hours. No, that's not how it works. Because, again, the Buddha is very clever and he didn't like committee meetings either. So what the Buddha did was that he set up a system of what they call Sangha officers. So the Sangha officer is simply that somebody is appointed by the Sangha to look after a particular area or a particular function within the monastery. And the kinds of Sangha officers that's talked about in the Vinaya are things like, say, somebody who's responsible for organizing the meals and the dhanas, right? Somebody who's responsible for looking after the stores, somebody's responsible for looking after the robes, somebody who's like a building master, looking after the building and maintenance of huts and so on. Somebody else might be, say, teaching Dhamma or teaching Vinaya and so on, training junior monastics and so on and so forth. So there are different kinds of functions and that Sangha officers can be appointed to look after those things. And obviously these days we have some Sangha officers in different areas that didn't exist in the Buddha's day. Somebody's looking after the fixing the pumps for the water supply, or somebody else is maintaining the vehicles or something like that. So we appoint somebody as a Sangha officer, and if we want to, we can give them guidelines from the Sangha, okay? But generally speaking, it's up to that Sangha officer to run their office as they see fit. And they have authority within that sphere, okay? So it's like they're like the head of the department or something like that. If that's the workshop monk and the workshop monk says, you know, clean this up, then you should clean it up because they have authority in that sphere. And it doesn't matter if I'm senior and they're junior or whatever, then it's still up to them. They have authority in that area. Okay? Very important to understand this. Seniority doesn't mean, in the Buddhist Sangha, doesn't mean you have any power of command. It means that people should listen to what you say with respect. Okay? So if I'm the senior monk and I talk in the Sangha, then people should listen to what I say with respect. Of course, you should listen to everyone with respect, but especially the senior monks. But it doesn't mean that they have to agree with me. Yeah? So, of course, sometimes people do the wrong thing and they don't do they don't do what they're asked to do and so on. So we've got to think, what do you do in that case? I remember when I first came back to Bodhinyana a couple of years ago, there was a discussion on that topic of the workshop, and the workshop was messy and dirty. And the workshop master, I didn't know this monk then at that time, Venerable Chunda, And so I didn't know what to expect. So he said, some people are leaving the workshop very messy, and if they keep on doing this, I'm going to have to do something. And I was thinking, wow, he's going to ban them from the workshop, or there's going to be something. And then he said, if I find out who's been making the mess, I'm going to go and I'm going to give them a big hug, because they're certain to be suffering. So sometimes you just need to do that, you know? And so sometimes people don't do the right thing, and so there has to be ways of dealing with that. But again, that happens in line with the vinaya, which is like the principle or the constitution that we follow, and as applied by the sangha, by the community as a whole. The sangha, interestingly enough, the sangha has to make all its decisions in consensus. How do we actually make decisions? Well, first thing is, what does the sangha mean? What does the community mean? Does it mean all the monks or all the nuns in the whole world? Right? So that would be very difficult to get all the monks and nuns in the whole world to agree on anything. Yeah. So, or does it mean everyone in Australia or in the city or whatever? So the Buddha said, okay, everybody within the monastery, and we'll define the monastery by what we call a sīma or a boundary. So we make a boundary and we say, okay, all the monks or all the nuns who are within that sīma at that time, they have to participate. Okay, so we clearly define who has to participate in that. All of the monastics who are there have to participate in the decision, right? So you have to be there. And the decisions, with some minor exceptions, always have to be made by consensus. Okay? So it's not majority rule. There are certain cases where majority rule can be applied, but the vast majority of cases, it's consensus. Okay, so consensus, of course, doesn't mean that everybody has to think this is the right thing to do, but it just means that everybody has to give their consent to say, okay, we're going to agree to go and do this. Even you might not think it's the right thing to do, but we'll let it go ahead anyway. So this is consensus decision making, right? Without any hierarchy. Yeah? So this is how we run things in Bodhinyana Monastery. And this is a process that Ajahn Brahm has instituted for many years now. We gather every fortnight with the whole community there, all the monks and the novices, and we deal with any business that has to come up, and we ask each monastic individually if they have any issues or anything that they'd like to raise up. Because sometimes when you're in a community, you might say, does anybody want to mention anything or ask anything? And sometimes people are nervous to say, right? They don't want to speak up. So we make a point of actually individually asking everybody, do they have anything they want to talk about? And many times, of course, they don't have anything, or they might just have something simple to talk about. And sometimes, you know, there are problems or issues, and we discuss those, and we deal with them as best we can according to the vinaya. So to me, this is a very, very powerful model for how a community can run. And when you apply it in practice, it's very light, right? It's not like, you know, if you have an organization or a group where you have to feel that you have to control everything, right? And then it's stressful, it's a hassle, and you're trying to control everything, and it never works the way you want, and then you get angry, and right? But on the other hand, doing everything, making all group decisions all the time is also a hassle. Everyone gets stressed out by long meetings and so on. So this way, you know, even Bodhinyana, it's a fairly sizable enterprise. You know, we've got all these different things we do. But we manage to keep it rolling smoothly along by just having one meeting a fortnight, which usually takes an hour or two. And that's all we need. Okay? And so if you try to suppress it too much, you don't have too many meetings, and everyone gets angry. They feel like they're not being heard. It's really important in a community that everyone should be actually heard. I was going to say then, I just caught myself, I was going to say that it's important that everybody should feel like they're being heard, right? But no, it's important that they actually be heard, right? Not that they just feel like they're being heard, but that they're actually being heard, right? So it's important that everyone should be heard, but it's also important that we can just do simple things without having to worry about it too much. And so we go on, we make the decisions that need to be made, and then we accept and we trust people to do their job. We support them when they need to, but we don't try to micromanage them or tell them how to do their job. So this is a very important part of how the Sangha works. Now, what happens when things go wrong? Right? So what happens when somebody does something wrong, somebody comes and complains? Well, there's, again, a very clear and beautiful procedure which the Buddha always follows in the Vinaya. And, you know, anyway, I'll just tell you what the procedure is. Somebody comes to the Buddha and says, this monk did that bad thing, right? And so the first thing the Buddha does is say, well, monks, go and get that monk and bring him to me. So they go and they get the monk, they bring him to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, is it true? Did this happen? Right? Now, just stop for a minute and think about that, okay? Think what happens in your company or your university or wherever you work or whatever when that happens. Somebody does something wrong. When you hear, right, this person did that or that person did that, what actually happens? Is the first thing that happens that you go to that person and say, is it true? Right? Normally, that's the last thing that happens, isn't it? Right? If it happens at all. Right? The gossip and the rumors go swirling around. Yeah? And nobody actually asks a person, is this true? Yeah? And so from the Buddha's point of view, this is a basic gesture of respect. Okay? If somebody's done something wrong, fair enough, we have to deal with that. But everybody deserves to at least be heard. Okay? We ask them, is this true? And sometimes they'll say, yes, it is true. Sometimes they say, no. Sometimes they'll try to get out of it. And we deal with that. Yeah? So if it's the case that it's not true, if it's just a rumor, or if it's a misrepresentation or something, then it's finished. That's all there is to it. Nothing needs to be done. If there is something to be done, then sometimes there needs to be some punishment. Sometimes there needs to be an act of forgiveness, right? So if that monk had insulted somebody or something, then it's up to them to go and ask for forgiveness. If they'd done some other kind of transgression, then they needed to do some kind of penance for that. So the punishments which you have in the Buddhist scriptures, chopping off of hands, cutting off ears. No, none of these are there, right? These aren't the kinds of things that we find, okay? In almost all cases, the punishment is simply confession, okay? That's all you have to do. You say, look, I did this, I'm sorry, I'll try to do better in the future. That's it. And that's the end of it, okay? So all of these rules which you've heard about, you know, 227 rules for the monks, 311 rules for the nuns, and then all of the hundreds or thousands of other rules which are not collected in those main groups of rules, right? Almost all of them, then you can clear them by just confessing it. So that's pretty good, isn't it? You can get away with heaps. In Burma, they have a saying, if you know the Vinaya, you can kill a chicken. the rationale not being that you should kill a chicken, but the rationale being that if you're like a Vinaya lawyer, you know enough about it, then you can find a way to get out of anything. Right? So that's not kind of the point, right? The point is not punishment and all of these things, but the point is to be honest and to acknowledge what you're doing. So just confession, and that is also, that's very powerful. Confession is done, if any of you have been in the Christian or Catholic traditions, then you know that the confession is also done in that tradition. But in that tradition, it's different because there's a hierarchy of confession, okay? There's the confessed and the one you're confessing to, right? The confessor and the confessee. Anyway, the person who confesses and the person who hears the confession. Whereas in Buddhism, they're both the same person, right? So again, this idea that there's no hierarchy, right? It's completely mutual. So when Ajahn Brahm gets back from his trip next week, if he has any offences to confess, he'll come to the monastery. He's been a monk for 40 years now, and he could see Venerable Wimutta, who's just ordained this year, and he could confess his offenses to Venerable Wimuta, and Wimuta can confess his offenses back. Okay, so there's no hierarchy in that. So there's no kind of you don't have those kind of power issues that you have. Like if one person knows everybody's secrets, right, then you're inviting trouble. So we confess to each other. It's very mutual. If there's a more serious kind of offense, then sometimes there can be a minor penance. Sometimes if it's something which involves a physical object, for example, if a monk or a nun receives money, which we're not supposed to handle, then we have to relinquish that money. And that's, again, quite a nice vinaya procedure. So let's say that I've received money for some reason. Maybe I'm walking down the street and somebody comes up to me and says, "Oh, Venerable, here, use this to have this money," and they give me this money and I don't know what to do, so I just take it. So I say, okay, well, I have to confess that. So how do we do that? Well, when we come to the Sangha, we confess the offense and we have to relinquish the money to the Sangha, right? But what do you do, because other monks aren't allowed to pick that money up either, right? So what do you do with it, right? Well, basically, there's two things you can do with it. Either you can kind of, if you think that there's lay people are going to be around, you can just kind of leave it there on the ground and just sort of maybe let the Anagarikas or somebody know, oh, there's this money that was offered and it's just there, do as you see fit, okay? But you can't tell them, you know, take that money and put it in the donation box or something like that, right? All you can say is, well, there's the money and, you know, we'll do as you see fit. Or the other thing you can do is you can appoint a money thrower away, right? And so you have a Sangha procedure and you can say such and such a monk is wise and he's not going to be corrupted by this money. So we're going to appoint him to be the money thrower away monk. Yeah? And so you have a vinaya procedure, you appoint that monk and that monk goes to somebody like somewhere like a cliff or something like that, and they have to throw the money away over their shoulder without looking where it lands. Right, so you're not allowed, there's no sneaky peeking and come back and get it later or something like that, right? Yeah, throw it away, huh? So we have all these kind of procedures of how to do things, but then there's no kind of further punishment or anything. That's just something, you've confessed it, you've dealt with it, it's finished. Yeah? And so all of the procedures we do, of course there are a few procedures that are more serious. If you've committed one of the four parajika offences, which is sexual intercourse, theft, killing a human being, like murder, and falsely claiming spiritual attainments, right? So if I come along here and I claim to be enlightened or claim to be a great meditator or something like that, when I know that I'm not these things, then this also is a parajika. So any of those four kinds of offences, you're immediately expelled from the Sangha, right? You don't have to do a Sangha procedure, okay? It's just on the as soon as you do that thing, you're finished, okay? And you can never reordain for the rest of your life, right? So that's it. Informally, you can kind of stay on as a novice, keeping the 10 precepts, or reordain as a novice, but you can never be a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni again for the rest of this life. So again, even though that offence is not, you know, there's no sort of severe punishment or anything like that, but it's extremely clear cut. Right? So it's very kind of unambiguous. And those rules go into quite a lot of detail about how to fall into those offences. And it can be quite easy to fall in those offences. For example, the rule about stealing, let's say that this was a bowl of some value. If it's of too little value, that doesn't matter. It's a bowl of some value. And then I decide, okay, I'm going to just nick it. Right? If I think I'm just going to borrow it or something, that's not a problem. But if I have a mind thinking I'm going to steal it, and then I reach out and I grab it like that, then I'm still okay. All right? I can just confess that. Okay? But once I've done that, I'm finished. All right? Once it's actually been removed from its place, that's parajika. And I might think, oh, no, that's really stupid, I shouldn't do that, I'll put it back again, but that's too late, right? I'm not a monk, and I can never be a monk again for the rest of my life, okay? So, they're very, you know, it requires quite a bit of mindfulness and care. That one's quite easy to fall into. So, So that's giving you some idea of the different kind of offences we have and the kind of punishment rules and things that come up with those offences. But again, the very important thing is that it's all very flat. It's not hierarchical. It's based on consensus. It's based on principle, right? And it's based on a sense of trust and maturity, right? Now, this can be problematic because, well, not everyone's trustworthy, right? I mean, it all sounds very nice if you think, well, you have to make consensus decision-makings, but what if you've just got an idiot there who just sits there and says no the whole time, right? It gets very, very annoying, okay? And it takes quite a bit to annoy a Buddhist monk, but we get annoyed anyway, okay? Right? And of course, you know what that's like, don't you? And you know what it's like to be in a workplace when you have people who are just, you know, highly narcissistic or very manipulative or very deceitful and these kinds of things. So it sometimes can be difficult to deal with people like that. Yeah. So sometimes you just have to ask, you know, the community will ask somebody to leave if they're causing too much disruption. Sometimes you try to work around it as best you can. There is a downside to that kind of trust that we have to people. But on the whole, most of the time it works well. And most of the time you find that if you give somebody trust, then they will repay you. Okay? They know that, and they will respond by acting in a mature way. Most of the time it goes like that. Anyway, that's what we tend to find. Okay, so I'll give you just a few more examples of how we're supposed to do various things. I mentioned before we have the various duties as far as cleaning the toilets and things, looking after the maintenance of the buildings, and so on and so forth. There's a whole chapter in the Vinaya on shoes, right? What kinds of shoes that monks are allowed to wear? Not like fancy ones decorated with peacock's feathers. And so a lot of these things, of course, they change over the years, right? So what was considered to be fancy in those days might be considered very plain these days. And so we're not necessarily, you know, very rigid about how we explain and understand these things, but we, you know, we look at it in context and we try to apply it in a reasonable way. And of course, you always find that people will have different opinions about that. And I don't think I've ever met two monks who always have the same opinions about everything in the Vinaya, right? We always disagree about something. So you learn to accept that and you learn to get along with that. And that's also another very important part of the Vinaya, is that the monks and the nuns have to decide for themselves what is an offence, okay? So if somebody does something, and I think that's an offence, right? But they don't think that's an offence. Okay, I can talk to them about it. I said, well, you did this. They agree, yes, I did that. And you say, but isn't that an offence? They say, no, I don't think it's an offence. And you can have a disagreement of opinion about that. Okay, but at the end of the day, if somebody doesn't actually confess to the offence, right, then there can be no, the offence doesn't apply. With a few exceptions, like in the case of the Parajika that I just mentioned. But generally speaking, if somebody doesn't confess to it, there's no offence to be reckoned with. Yeah. Another very interesting thing is that if there is some kind of punishment to be done, that the person who has the guilty party has to request that punishment. Yeah. This is a very, very interesting thing. So punishment is not imposed, right? Punishment is something that you ask for. Please help me, right? I've made a mistake. I want the Sangha to give me this penance out of compassion, right, to help to support me so that I can move on from this. Yeah? So there's not an idea of punishment, right? There's not an idea of I'm going to get back at somebody or, you know, somebody has to pay for it. It's an idea is not of punishment, but of support, right, of helping somebody through a difficult period. Okay, so in certain cases, then that penance might involve, you know, you might give like extra duties, yeah. But even those kinds of things, it's very limited what you can do. So, for example, the Buddha said if a novice, a young, newly ordained monastic misbehaves, then you can give them some extra duties or something like that. But he said in no way can you make a punishment with respect to food. Yeah, It's very interesting, these principles the Buddha said, right? You can't tell somebody, right, no more sweets for you for this week, right? Yeah, you can't say, yeah, that's up to them. You know, you can tell them, okay, look, you have to clean the toilets or you have to do extra sweeping or something like that. And so they do some extra chores or something, and then that can be their punishment or their penance, but that's all. So everything that we do is very kind of limited now, and guided by the structure of the Vinaya. So this means that Buddhism, the Buddhist Sangha, is very decentralized by its nature. And so even though we find tendencies within different national forms of Buddhism to create more centralized bureaucratic structures, but those things don't have any basis in the Vinaya. And what if you look back at the history of them, I won't go into too much into history now, but if you look in the history, you'll find that in every case, there was a lot of resistance among the Sangha to setting up those bureaucracies. I'll just give you one example. In Thailand, the whole Sangha is governed under a Sangha Act. It's an act of parliament which tells the Sangha how to live and so on. And that was introduced, the first one was 1902, if I remember correctly. And at that time, there was a lot of resistance to this idea, mainly led by a very respected senior monk in the north of Thailand called Krupa Wichai. And Krupa Wichai didn't think that it was appropriate that Bangkok should be telling them how to run their monasteries, that they should be appointing preceptors, that they should be, telling them what to do, basically. And he argued that on the basis of the Vinaya, right? The Sangha is meant to be decentralized. And so that's something which, even though these hierarchies and organizations exist to some degree, but generally speaking, the Sangha is aware that the Vinaya is supposed to operate in a decentralized way. And we were having some discussion about that recently in the Sangha in Australia with regards to issues of accountability. For example, in the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church, we've had the terrible scandals with child abuse within the churches. And the really bad thing, I think, with those is not that some people have misbehaved, right, have abused children or whatever. Okay, that's terrible. But the thing I think which has I think caused a lot of people to question the religious structures is the fact that it was covered up. Okay, you know, okay, we understand people make mistakes, they do bad things, but they need to be held accountable. And so the real problem was the cover up at the institutional level. And so, because the Christian churches tend to be organized in a much more top-down hierarchical way, there's much more of a sense of institutional responsibility for those things. Whereas in Buddhism, it's, if you imagine, like a kind of a loose or horizontal network, so we're not sort of responsible for the acts of other monks in that same way. And of course, that's kind of a good thing and kind of a bad thing, right? It means that if somebody is doing the wrong thing, there's nothing much we can do about it, okay? If it's within our monastery, we can, right? So our Sangha, we can deal with a badly behaving monk in our monastery, but we can't go down the road to the other monastery and tell them what to do, right? So this is a limitation in the Vinaya, and that's why that those higher level structures were developed. So of course, you can still advise people or reach out to them or whatever, but ultimately there's nothing that you can really enforce. So that system does have its limitations. And, we have to acknowledge that any system does. But it has proven to be very resilient. You know, you just think about that. You think about the difference in the time and the place. From ancient India, you know, the Buddha walking down these tiger-infested pathways through the jungle and how different that world was to the world we live in today. Right? And yet, even though it's such a different environment and different context, we can still use those same principles for running our community. It's really good. I find it just amazing. And it feels to me so modern and so fresh. And that if we go back to those principles and keep on looking at them, then that can provide us not only with a great energy and sort of quality of way that we can live within the monastic community, but I think that there's a lot that people can learn in the workplace, the family, community organizations, and so on. Many of the principles that I've been talking about, I think, are just as applicable there. So, of course, the Sangha has taken those basic principles and has applied them in different ways in different contexts throughout the years, with greater or lesser degrees of success and so on. And the Vinaya has proven to be very adaptable. And this is why you see if you go to China or Tibet or Sri Lanka or somewhere, then you see the monks behave differently. They keep different rules sometimes, organize differently. And even, say, within the Theravadan countries, the things can be quite different. So I mentioned before, say, in Thailand, there's a government act which governs the Sangha. In Sri Lanka, there's nothing like that. So even within Theravadan countries, they have quite different governing principles at that level. But the Vinaya provides us with a framework, something, a set of principles and core ideals and procedures that we can keep reflecting back on and coming back to. Yeah? All the way through the Vinaya, there's a flavor of peace. Yeah? And the one of the most important principles in the Vinaya is what they call the Adhikarana Samatha. Yeah? Adhikarana Samatha. Adhikarana means an issue, and samatha means settling, right? You're familiar with the word samatha from meditation, right? Tranquility meditation, calm meditation. So adhikarana samatha means settling of issues, calming of issues. Yeah? The number one most important of those adhikarana samathas is called sammukha vinaya. Sammukha vinaya has to be present in everything that the Sangha does. And sammukha vinaya means in the presence of, okay? And it means in the presence of three things. It means in the presence of the person who created the problem, right? The person who's guilty or has been accused. It means in the presence of the Sangha. Okay, I mentioned before, all the Sangha has to be together. And it means in the presence of the Vinaya. Okay, so the principles that we're following, right? Those three things have to be present at every act of the Sangha, right? And that's what we call Sammukha Vinaya. So these things, even though we can adapt and change and so on, but these things are really core, and these things we have to follow. And they lead to peace. They lead to settling. Yeah? They lead to people being able to live together, very different people. Yeah? And if you live in a monastic community, we don't have lots of enlightened people coming to ordain as monks. Right? Typically, we're unenlightened when we come to ordain. And I'm sure in the nuns' community is the same. Is that correct? Yeah. So maybe you get enlightened after a little while, shorter or longer time, and people become more peaceful and more mature and more wise, and we hope that those faculties will grow. But you don't necessarily have them very much to begin with. And that's okay. So we need a way to be able to live together with very different people, different kinds of energies, different ages, different cultural backgrounds, different interests and so on. They can live in a way that's samatha, that's settled. Yeah? And by and large, we can do that through the practice of Vinaya. So I won't go on talking about that too much. So that's just a brief introduction to the topic of the monastic code of the Vinaya and some of the principles that we use in order so that the Sangha can work, can operate in a way that's both in accordance with the ideals and principles of the Dhamma, but also is very pragmatic and very flexible when we cope with the realities of daily life. So I offer that for your reflection. And I believe Christina has some questions. Thank you so much. Very good. Okay, so we just have one question here from Dhirayupa from Thailand. Hello, Dhirayupa, how are you? Dear Bhante, an academic question here. What's the origin of Sema? I thought monks lived in the forest during the Buddha's time and that the Sema is a later invention. Okay, so just to remind you, I mentioned a little bit before about the idea of a Sema. Sema literally just means a boundary. Okay, Sema is just the Pali word for boundary. And so the Buddha said when you make a monastery, you should define the boundary of the monastery so that you can be clear about who has to be in the Sangha at that time and who's not in that Sangha in that monastery. So even though at the time of the Buddha, the monks and nuns would often live in the forest, still the Sema was established at that time. So the question says that they thought that the monks lived in the forest in the time of the Buddha. Yes, they did, but also monasteries were established already, and we certainly find that from an early period in the Vinaya. I mean, the reality is that, you know, it's not very easy to just sort of live in the middle of the forest by yourself, and so they sort of built huts and the communities grew and so on and so forth. So the way that the Sīma works is that, again, the notion of Sīma is very pragmatic, and perhaps the reason for asking the question is because in the in modern Buddhist culture, the notion of Sīma has become very highly ritualized and almost kind of magical in what it actually is. But when the Buddha did it, it's very, very simple and very pragmatic. So I'll just explain briefly the principles of the Sīma in accordance with the actual Vinaya. First of all, the monks were doing their uposatha, their ceremonies, and Buddha said, all the monks have to be there. They said, all the monks where? The Buddha said, all the monks in the monastery. Well, how do we define what the monastery? And the Buddha said, make a sīma. They said, how do we make a sīma? And the Buddha said, well, you say there's a rock over there, there's a tree over there, there's a lake over there. Everything inside that is inside the sīma. Okay? That's how you make a sīma. And that's all that it says, pretty much, in the Vinaya about making sīmas. Okay? So when we see all of the kind of elaborate ceremonies and so on and so forth, none of that is really kind of necessary. Okay? So all it is basically pointing out a few landmarks or markers. They can be natural ones or they can be artificial ones that you can use to delimit the area that you have. Now, again, because the Vinaya is very pragmatic, if you don't have a sīma which has been pointed out in that way, it will still default to a sīma. If you're living in a wilderness area, then it's what you call an aranya sīma, and it extends for roughly 100 meters around from where the sangha is. So even though you don't have a defined sīma, but by convention you call it an aranya sīma, it's about 100 meters in any direction. And if you're living in a village, then the sīma is the boundaries of that town or that village. Okay. So that means that if you have a monastery and you're staying in a village and you haven't defined the sīma for that, that means that all of the monks in that village would have to get together to make those decisions and so on. But that's how it works. So everywhere in the world actually is inside a sīma. There's nowhere that's not in a sīma, but it's just most convenient to define it in the monastery. So again, that's just giving you an example of how these things were done. So that's the only question we've got here for this evening. So we should finish up. Hopefully, any more messages, Cecilia? No? So hopefully I'll see you tomorrow for the meditation. Very good. Let's finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.